Well, good evening. Welcome back to our series on archaeology in the Bible. I'm sorry I missed you in person last week. That just happened to be the time the exhibit was opening. And so Laura and I went to Museum of the Bible for an opening of an exhibit. But hopefully the lesson was useful to you. And now you have no idea how much I made up because you couldn't ask questions. So worked out really well for me anyway. Let me say a prayer for us and we'll jump right in. Lord, I'm grateful to you for this group of believers, all those that are watching or hearing us. I pray, Father, that you would bless everyone for the desire to know your word, to let it seep into our hearts and let it come out through our hands, Lord, that we might do your will with grace and with truth. Father, I am burdened today, we all are, for prayers for peace in the Middle East. We're not wise enough to know how this could be settled, but you are, and I pray, Lord, that you would do what is just, you do what leads to peace, that all those mothers and fathers who value their children more than they value their hate, I pray that that would prevail. Pray for our nation, for the leaders of our nation, that you would turn their hearts and their minds toward you, that we might be what we were called to be, and that is a beacon of truth and justice in the world. We pray it in Christ's name. Amen. Well, as usual, here is a number for questions, so text your questions in during class. We are talking about archaeology in the Bible, and we're just moving around through different things. We talked about the Megiddo Mosaic, we talked about the text of the Old Testament, the text of the New Testament. We've kind of been working around questions that are raised about the Bible and what archaeology might have to say to that. I do believe that last week I mentioned to you that if you had questions and you wanted to send them in, we'd answer questions about last week's lesson, but I'm going to need to warn you, I barely remember last week's lesson, in all seriousness. Laura, do we have any questions?
We have several.
Okay.
Are the Dead Sea Scrolls the nearest Bible that Jesus would have read during his time on earth?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. Yes. The Dead Sea Scrolls, the text of what's in the Dead Sea Scrolls for the Hebrew Scriptures is what is the text that Jesus would have been reading. But the Septuagint, if you remember, so the Dead Sea Scrolls within 200 years before Jesus was born. So that, you could assume, that is the text of the Old Testament that was around at Jesus' time. And it's remarkably like the one that you're reading. But if you remember, about 200 years before Christ, because so many Jews no longer spoke Hebrew, no longer read Hebrew, that the Bible was translated in Alexandria, Egypt, from Hebrew into Greek, because a lot of Jews spoke Greek and read Greek, but not Hebrew. So the Greek version of the Old Testament was also clearly read by a lot of Jews at the time. So I can't tell you that he read that exact text, but he read the Hebrew or Greek translation of it. In fact, some of the quotations in the New Testament appear, because it's written in Greek, appear to be quoted from the Septuagint, the Greek version of it. Doesn't matter. I mean, it's a translation of it. But yes, that text of the Dead Sea Scrolls would have been the text that Jesus was reading.
Why do we not translate from the Vaticanus or other older codex? And is the Vatican forthcoming with their inventory of historical documents?
Two questions there. One, as far as I know, the Vatican is indeed forthcoming with making accessible to scholars their documents. We, as I mentioned, I think I mentioned this, perhaps I didn't do a very good job, but just remember, unlike the Old Testament, in the New Testament, we could just translate Codex Vaticanus, you know, a fourth century copy of the New Testament. We could translate that. It would be extremely close to what you have in your New Testament today. It wouldn't change anything of any importance. But because we have so many copies, instead of just picking that one, as reliable as it is, they thought, I'll bet we can make this even slightly more reliable by looking at all the other copies and comparing them. But yes, like I mentioned, if you just took Codex Vaticanus and translated it into English, you'd be a Christian without any theological problems with any other Christian. I mean, that's how close these things are. Good question.
Although not inspired and anonymously authored, does the Didache from 100 AD support the authenticity of the New Testament?
That's a really good question. So the Didache is, whoever asked that knows about this, but roughly, the Didache is an early, it's in Greek, written by somebody who's a Christian or group of Christians, very early. Early part of the second century, some would argue, so hundreds, like 110, 120, some would argue back before 100 this was written. So what is it? It is a guideline, sort of like guideline for new Christians, sort of. And it's kind of hard to describe, but there are pieces of it that just reiterate the gospel. There's a way that leads to life and a way that leads to death. Choose the way that leads to life. So it's very inspirational. But it also has some guidelines, like if you want to be baptized, okay, first, you need to know what you're doing. You need to fast for 3 days. You need to prepare yourself, that kind of thing. So it's not inspired by God, but it's really helpful. And the question is it useful? Yes, it's not definitive, but it's extremely useful. It doesn't quote a ton of scripture, but the church fathers do in that similar era. But it's very useful because it corroborates Christian practice and emphasizes Christian doctrine. So yes, the Didache, because it is so early, is useful. That's a good question.
What caused the large growth of new Greek New Testament manuscripts that were found in the 9th through 11th centuries?
That's a good question. So two things happened there. One, in general with archaeology, you need to be able to dig in the places that you're probably going to find those documents. Egypt, places where you have arid environments. I mean, you're probably not going to find too many papyrus copies from Africa. And not because they didn't copy the Bible in Africa, but man, it's going to be hard for a piece of paper to last 1,000 years in a humid atmosphere, right? So you have to be able to dig in the right places. And so you have, during the Muslim expansion, I mean, you've got to think about what's going on in the world, right? So in the Muslim expansion from 7th century up to that period of time, you got a lot of warlike situations. But then the Muslims pretty much conquered their piece of the world. And so things settled down a little bit. I'm not telling you this is the reason for that, but these are reasons why you'll see more excavations when things are quiet, right? A lot of reason why the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 1948 and not in the middle of World War II, right? So some of it are logistical factors like that. I'm not aware that there was any one big factor that made it go up there. It can also be a find. I think I told you about the Oxyrhynchus papyri, which come from Oxyrhynchus, a city in Egypt, and they found a trash heap there, and they dug it up, an ancient trash heap, and there are, did I tell you, like, there are about 500,000 fragments there? Okay, so you're going to get a lot of documents out of that once you sort it out, right? So things like that. I'm not aware that there was any one particular thing, but when you looked at the chart, it does seem to jump up in that time period. Good question.
Okay, speaking of the Oxyrhynchus papyri, Are we currently using technology, particularly AI, to analyze those types of things?
Yes. I had a good discussion before class about this, but here's the short version of that. Yes, but you have two factors working against you here, and they're just both very human. Number one, not all of those reside in the same place. Some are at different museums and different universities. And so, you know, getting cooperation, get it all together, that's not easy. I'll tell you one thing that really hurts you on this is scanning and storing them. It is not cheap to do high resolution scans. Those take a lot of storage. Now I want you to think about, 100,000 fragments. That is not cheap to store that in a way that an AI could get to it. But yes, it is being and will be used more and more to try to put the pieces together. But you also have to remember, it's not as simple as you think. All the pieces aren't there, right? And so, but yes, computer-aided work in that. In fact, computers are being used in a lot of ways, validated by humans looking at it, but computers are being used to do a lot of that kind of work analysis now. So that's why you see some of the great discoveries You remember, this is kind of obscure, but one of the documents from last lesson was what's called a rescriptus, a framey rescriptus. That means that this is a document that originally had some of the New Testament written on it, but because parchment, animal skin, was so expensive that somebody came in and just rubbed it out, you know, erased it with an eraser sort of, and wrote on it again, you know, "Hi, Mom, it's me. I'm just writing over a New Testament manuscript." They wrote something else on top of it. Computers, so you look at it and you go, well, that looks like it's a copy of the Iliad or something. But by scanning it with computers, you can actually see what was underneath it and bring that out. And so there are several interesting documents that have been recovered with the use of technology where you realize you can tell what was on there before they erased it. So technology, big answer to the question, technology is very useful in this field.
Okay. Is CE replacing AD?
CE is not replacing AD in my slides, but it is in the scholarly world. It has in the scholarly world. So what is BC and AD? So BC is before the birth of Christ. AD stands for a Latin for, I'm probably telling you stuff you know, so pardon me, but just in case. BC stands for before the birth of Christ. So anything before zero, basically. And then AD is a Latin phrase, Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord. And so when you write AD, what you're saying is our calendar is a Christian calendar made by Christian people way back in time. Well, now in a scholarly world, people realize, look, we got people that aren't Christian. We got scholars, we're agnostics, we're atheists, we're Muslims, we're Christians, whatever, you know, whatever you are. And we don't want to constantly be reminded of this bias. And so they changed it. And so it was changed to, instead of AD, it was CE, in the common era. Did they change when the calendar starts? No. Did they change the central event of history, the birth of Christ? No. A little late for that. But CE is basically intended to be a neutral thing. So instead of AD, which is a Christian thing, CE is in the common era. And BCE is before the common era. This is a Christian church. I'm teaching the Bible. I'll use BC and AD, but I don't mind BCE and CE. It's just, it's a nomenclature is really all it is. So that's a good question. It has replaced it in its scholarly literature. It's just considered the norm to use those two abbreviations. Great questions from last time. Well, this time, I want to move to a really different topic, and I want to ask this question, and this is a big question, and I want to take a slice of it. Are the stories in the Bible just versions of older myths? When you get to things like the creation story, the flood story, the Tower of Babel story, a lot of those things, even in the New Testament, you will have accusations that the Bible is basically influenced by secular sources. So I want to tackle the big question, are the Bible stories just versions of older myths? In other words, are they just the Jews' myths? So I want to answer that question. So let me start by just a little recap. So we talked about scrolls and codices, a codex. And so originally you had scrolls and they could be written on parchment, which you remember is animal skin, so think leather. These two are parchment. Whether it's a book, a codex is a book, whether it's a book or a scroll, or it could be written on paper, and the kind of paper they used came from the papyrus reeds. And they would put those plants together, press it, et cetera, make paper. You have paper books, paper scrolls, codex and papyrus. And that goes back a long time in history. But to talk about where I want to go back in history, you don't use scrolls and codices. You use far, far more permanent materials. And what I mean is, I'm not telling you they didn't write on animal skins. I'm just telling you they did not last that long. So what do you know? You pretty much know two materials, by and large. One is, on the left, I'm showing you an example of what's called the Merneptah Stela. It is a big piece of black granite. and on stone, and there are all kinds of stones, would be carved, in this case, Egyptian hieroglyphics. And those stones tend to stay around, right? Not all of them by any means, but when you dig something up, stone, well, that could be really, really, really old. And so I'll talk to you more about the Merneptah Stela and why it's important in the next lesson. But for now, I just want you to know that a lot of what you know comes from stone engravings. If you think about it, what you know about the Egyptians from, oh, let's go back to, say, 2200 BC, 2400 BC. When you think of the Egyptians, what do you think of? You think of hieroglyphics carved in stone. Okay, so that's more like the medium that we're going to see. The other thing that you'll see quite a bit of in our story is clay tablets that have been baked. So what I want to show you here, this is written in cuneiform. Cuneiform is a form of writing that basically looks like chicken scratching. I mean, that's just what it looks like. So I put an example in here, that little picture in the middle. You have a piece of soft clay, and this is exactly how they did it. And you have a stylus, a pencil, but the end of it is kind of triangular shaped. So you can press a little triangle, you can turn it, you can do this. Well, they have a system of impressions to make different syllables, right? So the thing on top there has been made with one of these little things, and that language is called cuneiform. And then they would take that clay, they would bake it. Well, it could be broken more easily than stone, but it is going to last a whole lot longer than paper. That makes sense? So a lot of the finds that we're going to talk about in this lesson go so far back, they typically go back about 4,000 years. They're going to be this kind of material. So I just wanted you to know that. And by the way, these two forms of writing, the reason I chose them is these are the two oldest forms of modern writing. Writing as you and I would understand it. I'm not telling you that there haven't been pictures of animals and people haven't communicated through stuff before. These are what you and I would consider writing. They were actually created documents to convey information. So Egyptian hieroglyphics and cuneiform are the two oldest forms of writing. So let's go back in history a little bit. I want to set the stage for this. This is what's called the Bronze Age. So the Early Bronze Age, this is what the Middle East looked like at that time, is from 3200 to 2000 BC. You have the kingdom of Sumer, the kingdom of Akkad, and later in this little city right here that isn't important at the moment but will become later, Babylon. And so this whole area, this is modern-day Iraq, by the way, Tigris, Euphrates rivers, this is Iraq. This is called Mesopotamia. And so I'm going to use that word. Excuse me. So Mesopotamia is this area. And it is home to some of the oldest civilizations ever known. So when I say Mesopotamian myths or Mesopotamian stories, I mean stories that came from the Sumerian people, the Akkadian people, the Babylonian people. I don't mean the Chinese people. They have stories too, which I'll hit in a minute. But I'm not talking about China. I'm not talking about India. I'm just talking about Sumerian, Akkadian, Babylonian. These are some of the oldest that we know of, that we have. And this is in the early Bronze Age. Fast forward a little bit. This is a busy slide. We're going to spend a minute here. This is in the middle Bronze Age. So Middle Bronze Age picks up in 2000 BC, and it goes to 1550 BC. This is when things get exciting in history, right? Because before that time, you don't have a lot of remains. But in this time, you start to see some stones, you start to see some clay tablets, some cuneiform, and things start to get really interesting. So a couple of things I want to point out here is Austin Henry Layard excavated Nineveh in about the 1850s AD, recent. This is, well, in archaeological terms, that's like real recent. And so in the 1850s, he excavated Nineveh. And when he excavated Nineveh, he found a lot of clay tablets that looked like this one here on the left. They were broken. And so because when they fall off a shelf, sort of like pottery, falls off the shelf, they break. Well, but you can put them back together, and you can see that happening. And they're cuneiform. At that point, I think there's only one person in the world that read cuneiform. And so they start to translate them slowly, et cetera. And they realize what they have found in Assyria are copies of documents. These are copies of documents that the original goes way back in time, back to those Sumerians and Akkadians and Babylonians way earlier in time. So they find these documents. So some of the documents that they found, and what I want to focus on is this. So I can't talk about all of the biblical stories. I'm going to pick one, and it's the poster child of the contention. If I were going to argue, which I'm not, that the Bible stories are just myths, and I wanted to choose my strongest case, I'd pick the flood story. So I'm going to pick the flood story, and that's what we're going to talk about. So where do the flood stories come from? Well, originally, in 1850s, they find these tablets, and they realize, and I'm simplifying this because there are a lot of flood stories, but there are three big flood stories that come out of this. One is an Akkadian flood story. So let me go back just a second and remind you. This is an old kingdom from around 2000. Sumerians are an old kingdom, and a little bit later, the Babylonians. Well, so they find in Nineveh these documents. There was an Akkadian epic called the Epic of Atrahasis. He was a king, and in this story, there's a flood. So it's a flood story, okay? It's a flood myth. Well, they also found a version that's a Babylonian flood story called the Epic of Gilgamesh. Now, Atrahasis is the hero of this story. The Noah, if you will, of this story is called Utnapishtim. I notice that's not popular now, but any of you expecting, good baby name right there, Utnapishtim. He was the Noah of that story that survived the flood. There's also a Sumerian, and these are different. These aren't all the same, okay? These are different flood stories, but they have some things in common. They've got somebody that survives the flood. They got a boat. They got a flood. They got some gods that are involved. And I'm going to go into detail in a few minutes. But right now, I just want to tell you, this is when this became an issue, is the 1850s, when you realize, oh, there are other flood stories. Maybe the Bible is just another flood story, okay? So this one, the guy who's the hero in this one is Sisudra. So I just want you to realize that these stories aren't the same. It's not like New Testament manuscripts where, oh, that's Peter. Oh, that's the gospel, or that's the letter of Peter. And they're the same. No, these are not the same. They're different stories, but they're flood stories, okay? Which makes you think, if you're a scholar in that era, well, you got these flood stories, maybe Noah's just another flood story. Does that make sense? That's where this comes from. And that's what I want to talk to you about. Okay, I'm not going to talk very much unless you ask questions, but really there's not much to be said about how about archaeological evidence of the flood itself. Now, this is archaeological evidence of flood stories, but can you find evidence of a flood? Have we found Noah's Ark? People keep looking, don't they? They believe that it's on Mount Ararat in Turkey and you can't get in there, but if you could, we're going to go find the Ark. Good luck with that, and I mean that with no disrespect. If it's wood and it's multi-thousands of years old, I don't expect it to be around, but hey, good luck. But basically, is there sign of a flood? So here, the city of Ur. Now, the reason this gets exciting is, by the way, 2000 BC is the dating for Abraham in the Bible. And he lived in Ur. And he dates to the traditional dating for Abraham is 2000 BC. So he's living there. Well, there's a British archaeologist named Leonard Woolley, in the 1920s, so 100 years ago, the 1920s, he says, I'm going to go find Ur. So he goes over there, he starts digging, finds Ur, ancient city of Ur. So he digs down, finds interesting stuff. He digs down and he finds some places 8 foot deep, other places 11 foot deep, mud. And he goes, that's the flood. That's the silt left from the flood, right? Others have found similar layers of deposits in other areas in this area. But I just want you to know, let me give you the short version of the story. There is not consensus on this issue, meaning that's suggestive, but not proof. And scholars are divided on whether or not there was a flood at all. If there was it really big or was it really small? And is this evidence of the flood? But that's what scholars get paid to do. But bottom line, I just want you to know, is there any evidence that there was a flood here? Yes. Is it conclusive? It is not considered conclusive. So there is some archaeology about the flood itself, but not conclusively so. So I actually want to, that's not the basis for people claiming that the Bible is a myth, is not that issue. So there's some evidence, not conclusive. So back to the stories themselves. So when Layard found these stories, he basically realized, and it hit the world like a ton of bricks when they were translated, in that, hey, there are all these myths of these different flood stories, and they differ. And so what does that mean about the Bible? And that's what I want to examine. I want to take this as our test case, and I just want to examine this because I'll show you what the fundamental contention is. So we're going to go to a little timeline. First of all, don't know when the flood was. I mean, there's nothing specific in the ground that can date it. And not everybody believes there actually was a flood, okay, to be fair. I mean, the people that accuse this don't necessarily believe that there's a flood. It's like, well, the Babylonians had a myth, Bible's got a myth. We don't even know if there really was a flood. Okay, so the flood happens sometime in history. This 3400 to about 3100 is when writing comes about. Okay, so this is where the cuneiform and hieroglyphics begin to actually happen. So there's nothing that we know of that was written down basically earlier than that. Okay, so you get some things that are written. Well, and this is hieroglyphics and cuneiform. So when do we date those flood stories that Layard found? The Epic of Gilgamesh, which by the way, I'm going to focus on that one. That one's, I'll tell you why a little bit, but it's the most complete. When were those originally written down? It is thought that they date to 2100 to 1700. So you got the Mesopotamian flood myths. And they are indeed myths. The traditional date for the biblical account of the flood, and there is so much debate about when the Bible events were written down, and that is not my point in this discussion. So I'm just going to use, Orthodox Jews would tell you, Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. Moses wrote down about the flood because God told him. This is the Orthodox Jewish view, and he did it in about 1400 BC. Does that make sense? That's all I need for this purpose. So here's the chain of reasoning. This is as scientific as it gets, and I'm not trying to bash it. I think sometimes we think there's more evidence for this than there really is. We already know there's not conclusive evidence of the flood not happening or happening, right? There's interesting info, but it's not conclusive. Nobody's going to argue. Nobody can prove to you the flood didn't happen, not even slightly. All you have is you have some stories. And the stories are similar. Some people will say, oh, they are so close that they clearly are the same story, not even slightly. I want to get into that in a minute and let you judge for yourself. But there are some things that are the same. You've got floods, boats, animals, and somebody survives the flood. Okay, there's some similarities, aren't there? Well, here's the reasoning. So these two things are similar, those Mesopotamian stories, even though they don't all agree, and the Bible story is later. So you know what the conclusion is? The Bible story is derivative from the earlier stories. It's later, it's similar. Therefore, well, that's just the Jews' version of that myth. Does that make sense? That's the argument, is, well, I got these old ones. They're a few hundred years older than the Bible, so the Bible obviously copied them. That's basically the argument. So I want to go further into this, but I want to stop right there, and I just want to say, if you think about it, that's not ironclad by any means. I'm going to give you an example. This may not be the world's best example, but work with me, okay? So let's suppose I find a document, and it says this: the flood left one person alive and two animals who were in the ark of Moses. Oh, that's interesting. Sounds like a weird flood story. I don't know how they all fit in the ark, you know, the little box kind of thing, but whatever. And I don't know what Moses has to do with it. But anyway, that's an interesting story. Ah, but then I find another story. It says Moses and some animals survived the flood in the ark. Oh, well, that's a boat. Well, that makes more sense. Well, I look at these two stories, and what do I think? You see the metaphor here, okay? This is not rocket science, but here's my metaphor. I got these two stories, and that's all I know. And I say, well, those are clearly related because I got a flood, and I got a flood. I got a person, right? I don't have a person there. Too bad. But I got a Moses here, and I got a Moses there. I got an ark, although that's a box, and I got an ark, although that's a boat. So they're similar. They're not identical, but they're similar, okay? Then I realize this one's older. Oh, well, that makes it easy. This one on the right was copied from the one on the left. They're similar, copied from the one on the left. That's the argument, fundamentally, about the Bible being, oh, it's just copied from one of the old Babylonians, okay? I'm not bashing it. I'm just telling you that's the argument, okay? Well, I'm going to propose something a little different. Well, that story came from that small group of people, and that story came from that small group of people. So it came from two different groups of people. Well, you could say, well, obviously somebody in small group on the left talked to somebody in the small group on the right and garbled the thing. What is a more likely, in my mind, and certainly possible, is it's the telephone game. So what if I told you this is the original story? Moses records that one family survived the flood along with the animals two by two in the ark they had made. Well, that makes a lot more sense. Can you see how we got the one on the left and the one on the right? It's sort of like if I whispered that statement to this side and the 12th person wrote something down. You know, the telephone game, right? Gets corrupted. Well, one group wrote down the one on the left, the other wrote down the one on the right. What I'm telling you is there may be no relationship whatsoever between those two stories, right? They could both be coming from something older, or in the case of the flood, maybe they're both coming from a real event called the flood. Do you understand what I'm saying? Is you don't, it's not necessarily true that those two stories influenced one another. Here they didn't. They just both garbled the truth. Here's another example that's maybe a little clearer. So I see a 16-year-old girl, and beside her is a 12-year-old girl. And I notice both have brown hair, both have brown eyes, both have the same nose. Those two look a lot alike. And so I say, you know, you guys look like you're related. And you're older than you are, so clearly you, 12-year-old, got your looks from the 16-year-old. That is this argument. And they both say, you're an idiot. We both got our looks from our mother, right? That's the point I want to make. And I know I'm making a little tongue-in-cheek, but in all seriousness, there's a big assumption being made when you say, I found some old flood stories. I think your story's just another one of those. Well, maybe they're both stories of the actual flood. So in other words, there are assumptions being made here, and I just want you to realize that. Fair enough? Okay, now I want to tell you about one of these stories. The best story is probably the Epic of Gilgamesh. And I just want to tell you this story. When we get through here in about 10 minutes, you will know more about the Epic of Gilgamesh than 99.9% of people in the world. So this is an interesting little story. So once upon a time, in the land of, in the city of Uruk, so it's really close to Ur, and archaeologists think around 2100 to 2000 BC. So this is right around the time Abraham's there, right? There's a king whom they believe actually existed named Gilgamesh. He was king of Uruk. Gilgamesh was a terrible king. He was good looking. He was urbane. He was well-dressed. He was incredibly rich. He had a reputation for being a real athlete, a lion hunter, that he basically had mastery over animals, so he was a great hunter kind of a thing. He was just kind of a guy that had it all going for him. But he was a tyrant to his people, didn't treat them well at all. This is the Epic of Gilgamesh that I'm telling you. I'm giving you the Reader's Digest condensed version. This is the story. And so the people, his people, prayed to the gods and said, give us some relief from King Gilgamesh. He's such a tyrant. The gods heard them and said, yeah, he's a little uppity. He's a little too big for his britches. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to create his opposite. And they named him Enkidu. And so they created a creature that's the opposite of Gilgamesh. He's just as strong. He's just as powerful. But where Gilgamesh is good looking, Enkidu, not so much. Where Gilgamesh is a city dweller and urbane and knowledge, Enkidu is like a man of the wild. He's almost half wild animal. So he's untamed and tamed. And we're going to send Enkidu to fight against Gilgamesh. It's like matter and antimatter, okay? So they do. Enkidu shows up, and the two of them say, we're going to have a fight. I don't know why. This is the story. So they fight, and they battle. And at the end, Gilgamesh barely wins, but they develop this great respect for one another. And they become really close friends, brothers in arms. From then on, they do everything together. So it kind of backfired a little bit on what the gods were saying. And by the way, this is one of the tablets of, in cuneiform, of the Epic of Gilgamesh. So they become fast friends, and they start to have adventures together. And so the two of them go on a quest to the cedar forest, and Humbaba the giant, even uglier than his picture, and he is a giant and can't be defeated, but as you can see from this ancient carving, Gilgamesh and Enkidu slay Humbaba the giant, the guardian of the cedar forest. Well, one of the gods or goddesses named Ishtar, who you've probably heard a lot about her in history, she shows up all over the place. But today, she shows up in the sense that, according to this story, she thinks that Gilgamesh is quite the hunk. And she really falls in love with Gilgamesh. And so she approaches him and says, you mere mortal, well, this is your lucky day. I want to marry you. You get to marry a goddess. And Gilgamesh says, no, I know some of your exes, some of your ex-husbands, and it didn't work out well for them. No, I don't want to marry you. You know what happens when you say no to a goddess? According to the Epic of Gilgamesh, she gets very, very angry. She goes back and tells the other gods, Gilgamesh is such a jerk that he doesn't want to marry me. And so the gods say, we will unleash the bull of heaven, and the bull of heaven will probably stomp Gilgamesh and Enkidu. Alas, Gilgamesh and Enkidu kill the bull of heaven. Well, this is no longer just a love thing with Ishtar. The rest of the gods say, okay, that's gone too far. And so Gilgamesh needs to be taught a lesson. And so they decide that they are going to kill his bosom buddy Enkidu. And so they give him a disease. And sure enough, Enkidu dies. This is the Epic of Gilgamesh. I'm leaving out tons of details, but this is the story. And so Enkidu dies. Oh my goodness, Gilgamesh is struck. He's struck with two things, sadness for losing his brother, his friend, and he all of a sudden becomes scared to death that he too is going to die. The death of his close friend makes him realize he's going to die. Have you heard of flood in this yet? No, because the flood is a side note to this, but we're going to get to the flood. So he becomes scared to death that he's going to die, but he heard an ancient story about a man who is immortal, a man like him who became immortal. And this man's name was Utnapishtim. And according to legend, He lives in a far, far away land. And so Gilgamesh leaves his kingdom, leaves his throne, and begins to search and search and search for the distant land where Utnapishtim is so that he can ask him, how can I become immortal because I'm scared to death to die? Finally, after all this searching and all these adventures, he finds Utnapishtim. So Utnapishtim is a guy living with his wife in a far, far away land, and they talk when they come together. And Gilgamesh says, I understand that you are immortal. How did you become immortal? This, now, is the flood story. As you can tell, it's a total sideline in this. Utnapishtim says, curious you should ask me that. Something really funny happened to me. He said, back in my day, one of the most powerful of the gods, his name was Enlil, god of storms, god of weather, stormy god, stormy personality, right? Jerk. And so he says, mankind is too noisy. And the other gods go, I know, they woke me up again last night. That humanity is, this is the story, people, that humanity is making too much noise and we need to do something about it. And then Lil comes up and he says, let's just kill them all. I'm tired of these guys. We're gonna kill them all. We're gonna eradicate the human race. Well, some of the other gods go, gosh, that sounds kind of drastic. And he goes, well, how long do you want to put up with waking up in the middle of the night? And they go, okay. So Enlil decides, I'm going to kill all of humanity. Well, he goes over to his friend, and this god has two names, Ea or Enki. I'm going to call him Enki. So Enki is the god of water. And he says, Enki, you know what would be easy here? Why don't you just drown them all? And so Enki goes, I don't really want to do it. And Enlil says, I'll beat you up if you don't. And so he goes, okay, I will. But he goes and he whispers through a bush to a man named Utnapishtim. How did he pick him? We don't know. And he says, listen, you need to tear your house apart and use the wood of your house to make a boat. And in this boat, you better take anybody you can fit that you want to save, because I'm going to flood the earth and we're going to have to kill all of you. By the way, you might want to take some animals for afterwards. And so Utnapishtim and his wife and some artisans and all these people come together, and they make this boat, and they concoct a story to tell everybody else, because there's not room for everyone in this boat. I mean, this is a real interesting story. And so they get some animals in the boat, and sure enough, he builds the boat in 7 days. And then it starts to rain, and it rains for 7 days and floods everything. And at the end of 7 days of flood, the boat comes aground on a mountain. And so he thinks, well, I wonder what's going to happen. So he lets a dove go. Dove comes back. It's like there's nowhere to land. A few days later, he lets a sparrow go. This is a little different than the Noah story, isn't it? Lets a sparrow go. Sparrow comes back. Waits a little bit longer. Lets the raven go. Raven never comes back. So they get out of the boat, tear the boat down, make a fire, sacrifice one of the animals, and it says the gods came like flies, you know, to smell the sweet sacrifice of these people. In the meantime, Enlil is furious. How did somebody survive this thing? We intended to wipe out all of humanity. This guy survived. And they go, what can you do? Stuff happens. And so, in a surprising twist of fortune, Enlil comes down, puts his hand on Utnapishtim's head, his hand on his wife's head, and said, you know, since you guys made it through it, I'm going to make you immortal. And he gives them immortality and says, now you got to live way over here, though, because I cannot handle the noise. And so send him off into the far land, and that's where he lives. That's the flood story, okay? So Gilgamesh says, wow, what a weird story. That's how you got that? You think there's any way for me to get that? And he says, well, I'll tell you what, Gilgamesh, if you want to conquer death, let's see if you can conquer sleep. So stay awake for 7 days. He goes, I can do that. Promptly falls asleep. And so that's kind of the end of the story. There's a little bit more, but that's the end. And I'll stop there for our purposes. That's a flood story. How much to you does that sound like the biblical account? Well, you got people, you got animals, you got a boat, and you got a flood. And there you will read that the similarities are so striking they must be related. Well, there are some similarities, but what I just told you has huge, huge differences, doesn't it? So my point to you is, there is no fundamentally, it's an assumption to say these two things are connected. I would argue, seems to me personally much more likely that they're both reflections of something that really happened. Now, there are other flood stories as well. Chinese have a flood story. Hindus have a flood story. There are flood stories from a long around, and they're all different. But they do have some things. You got a flood, you got a boat, you got people, and you got animals. Okay, fair enough. They have some similarities, but they're very different. Some have argued there's as many as 70 flood stories out there. But I picked this one because this is the one that people are going to use as the poster child for this is a lot like the Bible. Okay? So that's an example. I just want to make some comments on it. I'm not here to say that all this scholarship is not any good. I'm just here to say that, wait a minute, this is not nearly as ironclad as you're going to hear it to be told to you. There are a lot of assumptions being made in this. But I want to make some observations. So what observations can we make? There was a flood. I mean, there just was a flood. What are the odds you got all these flood stories in all these cultures, and there never really was a flood? Very, very unlikely. I would argue that the most likely thing is there actually was a flood. Okay, so that seems like a no-brainer to me. The odds are there was a flood. Interestingly, the Sumerian stories date from about 2100 BC, and they are a collection of independent stories. It's not until the Babylonian epic, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and this is why it's the poster child, from the 1700s BC, these things appear to have been put to, and I do agree with this, they really do appear like they collected them, put them together in a story. Okay, so that's why the Epic of Gilgamesh is the poster child. It actually tells a story. I mean, a weird story, but it tells you kind of a story. Strings all these events together. All those adventures of Enkidu, those were independent stories. So Babylonians collect them together, put it in a book, sell it at Barnes & Noble. And so that's the Epic of Gilgamesh. The biblical account was written later. Let's assume for our purposes that it's written, say, 300 years later. It's definitely written later. It is part of a very different epic tale. Do you know what, when I say that, you know what I mean is you got the Sumerians telling you stories about this hero, different names, but basically this king who's a hero, and there's a flood, and it figures in, and the Babylonians put that all together. And so you kind of got a story. And I told you that story. Well, that's an interesting story. It's odd, but it's interesting. The biblical story is a way different story, isn't it? So just like the flood is a little piece of the Gilgamesh epic, Noah, you know, Genesis chapter 6, is a little piece of a bigger tale. And those two tales have nothing to do with one another. Okay, so the story of the Bible, story of Gilgamesh, those two stories, they aren't even close to being the same story. So I'd make that observation, is that if you want to say the flood stories are so closely related, they must be related, and yet the epics into which they are embedded are nothing like each other. No one will argue that they are related. That strikes me as odd, as very odd, that if the Hebrews are going to copy the flood story, why don't they copy the killing the giant story? Right? I mean, why not copy some of the rest of it? Well, they don't. I find that interesting, right? So let's talk about how the biblical account is different, because this is what I really want to highlight, is I just simply want to point out to you that this, you're going to hear this like it's a done deal. This isn't even slightly a done deal. And the biblical account is radically different. I'm just talking about the flood account now. First is this. The Epic of Gilgamesh and all the other flood stories that I've talked about here, we just talked about that one, have deities. So both of them have a god or gods, right? You've got Yahweh, and you've got Enlil, Enki, and a whole host of other gods and goddesses. But they are anthropomorphic and anthropopathic deities. What does that mean? An anthropomorphic deity, anthropomorphism, is projecting human traits on something that's not human. So you know this, the gods of the Sumerians and the Akkadians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans and tons, and the Hindus, I mean, tons of others, their gods look an awful lot like real powerful humans. They look kind of human often, but they act like humans, blown up, personified in a big way. In other words, they're not really different from humans, they're just real powerful. It still looks like an episode of Desperate Housewives. You know, I mean, it looks like a very human story, and usually not the best of a human story. The gods in these stories are not nice people at all. It's almost like you get the worst of people. They also are tied to the physical reality. Enlil is the god of storms. Enki is the god of water. Ishtar, she's the god of romance, let us say. In other words, you get gods and goddesses who have their little thing that comes from this world. Anthropomorphic. Anthropopathic is projecting human emotions onto something else. They feel like human. They've got anger, envy, etc. So all of the deities in this are what I would call superstitious deities. That's my opinion, that's my term. But they're basically anthropomorphic and anthropopathic deities. You see that a lot. The story of the flood and the Bible in general is not. Yahweh is not a bigger than life human. Yahweh is transcendent, outside of time, above time, does not have a human-like form, all-knowing, all-powerful, not just the God of the water, not just the God of this, the God and the creator of everything. The deities in these stories are radically different, radically different. One sounds made up. That's just, I'm giving you my opinion. That's superstition. Well, you got the God of the water, you got the God of the Nile, you got the God of this. The Hebrew God is not one of those kinds of gods. Now, I'm not telling you that proves that the Hebrew God is real. I'm just saying there is a huge, huge difference in those two pieces of this story. Second, in the stories, not just the story of Gilgamesh, the others as well, those Mesopotamian stories, the reason for the flood is to eradicate humanity because they're annoying. That's it. In every one of them, we're getting rid of them because they made me mad. It's sort of like the ultimate with your two-year-old, I've just heard enough, go to timeout and let daddy decompress, right? Okay, well, this is it in an anthropomorphic way. The gods have said enough of this, I'm killing all of you. You know, I'm tired of it, okay? Whereas the story of Noah is not God trying to eradicate humanity. God is trying to get evil out and intentionally has a survivor to continue the story of humanity. That's a big difference. Nobody's supposed to survive the flood in the Mesopotamian stories. Noah is supposed to survive the flood so that God can make the world better. He can prune out the unrighteousness. Now, you may like it or you may not like it, but you got to admit, that is really different. So for all the superficial similarities, and they are there, there's floods, there's boats, there's animals, and there's people. There are huge dissimilarities, radical dissimilarities. In one, you have gods that are mad, and the other one, you have a God who hates unrighteousness but loves humanity enough to rebuild it. Humans as slaves versus humanity as children. In all of the other stories, humans are just the slaves of the gods. You exist to make sacrifices to us because we love to be adored. Whereas the story of the flood is for God so loved the world that he made this plan of redemption to bring goodness out of it. I mean, if you think about it, Noah leads to Abraham, leads to Moses, leads to David, leads to Jesus Christ, leads back to the Garden of Eden. This story is way different. This God is way different. This God thinks we're his children. Those gods think we are annoying pests. There are huge differences in these stories and huge differences behind what's happening. Finally, the randomness of life versus purpose and meaning. One of the interesting things about the flood story, the whole Bible, but the flood story in particular is, If you read the Epic of Gilgamesh, what do you come away with? I'm important? No, you're not. God's wanted to kill you, they just failed. I have meaning and purpose. No, you don't. You're an annoyance to the gods. You're only here and you're just lucky to be here. Your life's gonna be nasty, it's gonna be brutish, it's gonna be short, but sacrifice to the gods or they'll kill you right away. I mean, that's the thing. What's my purpose? I'm special. No, you're not. You're just here as an accident and we would wipe you out if we could have, right? That's the story, the Epic of Gilgamesh. What does humanity look like? Not very important. It's all about the gods. Switch over, story of Noah. You get the idea that there's a purpose. God's not just annoyed because people are loud. God is basically saying evil is going to overtake the world and it's leading to huge injustice and suffering and corruption. And I am going to redeem that. Radically different role of who you are. You read the Noah story and you go, I'm a survivor of Noah. I'm not an accident. I'm here as part of the redemption story. Is this making sense? I just want you to realize how radically different these stories are in all of these ways. This is true with much later stories as well. The relation, the Bible is unique in these kinds of aspects. Scholars don't look at, don't think about these aspects enough, in my opinion. You look at what are similarities, and they are similarities, but I would argue they're relatively superficial when you get down to what the narrative is really about. And then finally, the embedding of this story. The story of Noah is embedded in a story of a loving God who created good things. We basically fell, we sinned, we disobeyed, and God began a process that led to him sacrificing his own son because he loved us so much. All the other stories, nothing has anything like that. It's all random, it's all the gods are mad. Now, so here's my test. This is not scientific, but here's my test for you. If you were gonna make up a story, which one of those two stories sounds made up? Well, I will tell you that the Sumerians and the Akkadians and the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, nobody made up a story like the Bible. Loving God, redeeming, blah, blah, blah. They typically make up the other stories. Life stinks, people are bad, I bet the gods are just as bad, hate the world, can't make sense out of it. That's not a made up story, that's called superstition. That's called trying to figure out what life means and you just have a very superstitious answer. You would not, you could not make the story of the Bible up. Who in the world says, I think there's a God and I think he loves me? That's not what people have traditionally done. It's making sense? This is a lot less likely to be made up than the other. So am I telling you that I can prove to you that, oh, the Bible's right and everything else is wrong? No, and nor should I, because I don't think that's what God intended. Nevertheless, a rational person, in my view, looking at this, looking at all those Mesopotamian flood stories, looking at the similarities, but looking at the huge differences, would say the Bible is unique. And the Bible says something very different than what anything else says. So in a nutshell, that's my answer to, is the Bible just a derivative myth? No. The evidence, it makes that extremely unlikely. You may believe the Bible's true or false, but I do not think you can make a solid, rational connection that it's just a copy of an older myth. Make sense? Even if you don't think, you don't have to be Christian or Jewish to look at it and go, those things are not related. You know, I may not believe either one of them, but that is not very much like the other. And that's the point I wanted to make. From a rational point of view, the Bible is unique, very different. So that leads me to the question that I'd like to explore for 2 weeks. And this is probably the question you probably hear the most recently. And that is the Bible historically reliable or does it have all kinds of historical errors in it? I'll leave you hanging with that till next week. And we're going to look at a number of those and see, does it have historical errors or does it match history? I'll see you guys next time.